My name is Kate Swanell, and you're listening to the MJA podcast. Bacteriophages were discovered about a century ago and were used as a treatment for infections until the discovery of antibiotics in 1925. Since then, phages have been largely ignored in Western medicine, while Eastern Bloc countries continue to research and use them. Today, a small community of Australian scientists and clinicians are investigating phage therapy once again, hoping to build an evidence base which will convince regulators and their clinical colleagues of phage therapy's safety and efficacy. Dr. Alexandra Petrovich-Fabijan is a postdoctoral researcher, and Associate Professor Ruby Lin is project manager, both at the Centre for Infectious Diseases and Microbiology at Westmead Institute for Medical Research in Sydney. They have co-authored a narrative review of bacteriophage therapy for the MJA, and they are my special guests today. What is a phage?
Phage is a virus that kill bacteria only, and there are researchers that show they don't do any harm to humans. Their structure is like in other non-animal and plant viruses, but okay. Most commonly the therapeutic phages are double-stranded DNA virus. In genetic terms, they're about 100 to 200 kilobase long, and they're grouped as tail viruses, so they have tails, they look like spiders.
How do they attack bacteria? What's the mechanism involved?
So in general, bacteriophages start their killing by recognizing specific binding surface structure on bacteria. And this reaction is very specific and can be explained by using the lock key analogy. Only the correctly sized key, in this case phage, can fit into the keyhole bacterial surface protein of the lock, which is actually bacteria. So it's unlike antibiotics, which also attack natural bacterial flora, bacteriophages can be extremely picky, and their whole range comparing to antibiotics is quite narrow. So some good example of picky phages, for instance, are phages that are specific for example, for Klebsiella or Acinetobacter baumannii, as the primary receptor for these species are capsule, and this structure can be quite diverse in these species. So in contrast, most phages specific to Staphylococcus aureus exhibit wide host range, which was the case with anti-staphylococcal cocktail we actually used in our clinical trial, and which is active against more than 95% of clinical isolates we tested in vitro. So after that initial step, after attaching to bacterial surface, phages are injecting their genetic material and then using bacterial machinery to replicate and produce new viruses, new variants. And sometimes phages can kill bacteria, sometimes they live in bacteria and they don't actually kill it. And we have terminology for these different lifestyles of phages. So according to their biology, they are divided two main groups, two main types, lytic and temperate phages undergoing lytic and lysogenic cycle. So from therapeutic aspect, we are only interested in those in the lytic or virulent phages because they always kill their host. So we have the ways to identify those virulent or lytic phages by using, for example, whole genome sequencing technologies, which help us, for example, to identify the genes that are involved in lysogeny, which is characteristic of temperate phages. Temperate phages, in our case, is not suitable for phage therapy because they have the integrase genes and repressor genes, and those genes enable those phages to potentially integrate into bacterial genome and, for example, enhance their virulence or pathogenicity. So the phage replicative cycle is generally held to follow classic dynamic predator and prey interaction based on population size and interaction between them. And we have an expression that is called MOI, so that means multiplicity of infection, which is actually a ratio of phages to bacteria, and usually 0.1 MOI, which means one phage or less 0.1 phage to one bacteria, is shown to be effective in mouse model, but an optimal MOI in humans has been suggested to be 10 or over. So usually phage activity correlates with phage in vivo activity, but sometimes that's not the case, and it might be different, so it might be unique for each phage.
So it sounds like phages are much more specific in their action than an antibiotic, for example.
Yes, they are very specific, so sometimes, as I mentioned, they can be specific to particular bacterial strains, but they are usually specific to bacterial species. For example, we have phages that are attacking and are active only against Staphylococcus aureus. So in case of our clinical trial, we also looked into the microbiome of our patients to see if there is any effect of Staphylococcus phages microbiome community, and we won't see any effect because the phages are so specific and they are just killing the pathogenic bacteria. Well, we couldn't actually see any changes in the microbiome, which is actually good. And when we are using antibiotics, we are killing everything.
So we've known about phages for a long time, about a century. Why did they fall out of fashion?
There's a lot of stories around that. So they fall out of interest because of the discovery of antibiotics by Alexander Fleming in 1929. The Western medicine pretty much adopted antibiotics really quickly instead of using phage. But there are phage therapy development that is continuing in the Eastern Bloc, so Georgia, Poland, and Russia. And there was a rumor that Stalin actually endorsed phage therapy in Georgia. So phage therapy became a geopolitical story. And there are actually quite a few salacious stories around phage therapy and why it's been adopted in Eastern Bloc instead of, you know, Western medicine. It's quite an interesting story. The reality is that, and pretty much the main problem, is that phage therapy is viewed through Western medicine as uncontrolled studies. There is no control group. They just treat the patient. And also, most of the published and available literature over the past, you know, 100 years or so on phage is actually in Russian.
Yes.
So, you know, you can see this can be a problem. And so this is rather a geopolitical choice than a medical one.
Your narrative review looked at the literature. What's the biggest problem with us just starting to use phages now in a clinical way?
At the moment, it's unregulated. All the regulatory bodies have different rules. They still don't know how to categorise phage in which category. So initially, it's under investigational medicine. It's the investigational drug, and now it's categorised as medicine. So, you know, in the past, phage has been categorised as probiotic.
So are phages parasites?
Yes, as mentioned before, some phages, like the lytic one, the virulent ones, mm-hmm. are exclusively parasitic. Again, only for bacteria. So far, we are aware there is some interaction of phages with eukaryotic cells. And as such, they are ideal therapeutic candidates. So the phages are usually very specific bacterial species, sometimes specific to the strain, which makes them very attractive and alternative, non-noxious to antibiotics to combat refractory infections caused by multi-drug resistant bacteria.
I'm chatting with Alex Petrovich Babajan and Ruby Lin about phage therapy. You can find their narrative review on the subject at mja.com.au. Don't forget our podcasts are all open access, and you can subscribe to our feed via iTunes. Back to our chat. Are they easy to produce? If the evidence suddenly says we've got to use this stuff, is it easy to produce in big numbers?
Yeah, it's actually very easy to find bacteriophages and isolate them with, say, de novo from different sources. As they are the most abundant biological entity on our planet, different types of environments, so practically wherever bacteria are present, phages are existing with them also. So they can be isolated from the soil, from the water, from different clinical samples, etc. For example, I went to collect some samples from Parramatta River after the storm, and I isolated more than 30 phages specific to common pathogens such as E. coli, Klebsiella, Pseudomonas aeruginosa and Acinetobacter baumannii. So just from that one sample, we got 30 phages. Yeah, you can get phages from clinical samples and also, and once you isolate the phage, there are different methods to scale them up. And usually the phages are combined into cocktails that are suitable for human application to avoid the development of a resistance. So when you combine phages, it's better than using individual phages because the development of the resistance is less likely to happen. So for clinical application, we do purification steps because when we are growing phages, we are using bacteria to propagate them. So we want to make sure that we get rid of all bacterial leftovers such as endotoxins in gram-negative bacteria. If the gram-negative bacteria is the host, or proteins or different bacterial genetic materials, etc. So currently, there are two main routes popular in the world to produce phages which are safe for human use. So there is a FDA-approved phage cocktails produced under GMPs of good manufacturing practice conditions. And those cocktails are usually combinations and formulations of 3 to 4 bacteriophages with wide host range. So, for example, we use ABSL1 phage cocktail from Amplify Bioscience to treat our 4 patients with severe staphylococcus infection. So the other route, which is popular in Europe, but particularly in Belgium, is called magistral phage preparation, and it in U.S. is known as compounding pharmacy, which means by using the tailor-made phages, individual phages, or the cocktails, as a medicine to treat single infection. So magistral phage framework is, as I said, mostly used in Belgium, but its implementation is also happening in France, Switzerland, Germany, and so on.
Why aren't we just solving the multi-resistance problem with phages? Why are we waiting? Why are we not doing this on a mass-produced level right now?
It's more complicated than that because phages are live, so it's hard to do quality control and standards of a live product. And, of course, there's the regulations surrounding that kind of product as well. The fact is there are actually a lot of unknowns, so that's why, you know, we need to go back to study fundamental research or fundamental biology, how phage is interacting in the presence of its host, its bacteria host. But at the same time, if we're talking about clinical application of phage, you know, how that interacts with a human.
The bottom line is the evidence base is not strong enough yet?
Yeah, it's still not strong enough to convince a lot of people phage is effective. In our clinical trial, we use it in conjunction with antibiotics. So, you know, you can have people that argue that, you know, patients are better because of antibiotics, not because of phage.
And are there plans to do stronger RCTs on this using controls without phages and controls without antibiotics?
In regards to that, so far, generally, phages are used on compassionate basis worldwide as add-on to antibiotic treatment known as adjunctive phage therapy, right, in our study. And you can see there are high-profile cases in the media present. And in our trial, which was uncontrolled, but first application of GMP phages via intravenous route in human, we showed that adjunctive therapy, bacteriophage therapy, was safe and well-tolerated in severely ill patients with staph sepsis and infective endocarditis. Bacterial load knockdown. When we started phage therapy, we observed some beneficial immune response in critically ill patients with infective endocarditis, and only within 3 days after we started phage treatment. And we also saw, as I mentioned before, no significant effect of phages on gut microbiome. But as you mentioned, to progress in this field, we still need to determine optimal dose and optimal treatment plan, and for that we definitely need to carefully design and conduct randomized controlled trials. And on that side, we also need to do lots of things. For example, we need to focus on developing high throughput, fast and accurate phage susceptibility testing, as well as how phages are interacting with antibiotics, not any antibiotics, clinically relevant antibiotics, and then utilize these findings to optimize phage therapy application in humans. And we also need systematically to curate phage biobanks with phages that are available for both research and therapeutic purposes that will primarily serve, for example, researchers as myself to develop suitable phage therapeutics. So as you can see, there is still a lot of fundamental biology research that needs to be done before phage becomes a part of standard care.
Apart from your group at Westmead, are there other groups around the country working on phage therapy?
There are quite a few, but a lot of them are doing in vitro. So we actually are the first group that actually looked at the interactions of phage in humans. We treated severely ill patients with phage. So just going back on what Alex highlighted, the limiting factor is actually regulation. So the regulatory bodies like FDA, TGA and EMA actually don't know what to do with phage. And the other limiting factor is actually the GMP preparation of phage. So, you know, you can actually extract phages from soil samples and, you know, water samples, etc., like electrolyzed. But to make it purified enough, so getting rid of endotoxins and all the impurities, actually the limiting factor, because it's costly, every fudge behaves differently. So you actually have to understand the characteristics of the fudges in order to make those preparations. And you mentioned about method of delivery. So for the clinical application, the best way is intravenous. And we are actually the first group in the world to actually do that. So in our clinical trial, we had bacteremia and infective endocarditis cases. Yeah. So in those settings, intravenous administration of phages are the best way. In one of the cases, we actually had a patient with ventilator-associated pneumonia and empyema due to Pseudomonas infection. So in this case, we actually use both IV intravenous as well as nebulized phage for inhalation treatment. So as Alex highlighted, you know, before purification of phage to GMP standard, so good manufacturing practice, it is ideal because you have to get rid of bacterial toxins and et cetera. And the advantage of using intravenous administration is that it's systemic, so it can reach all the sites of infection. And, you know, we have to keep on emphasize that we're still trying to find out what phages do to our immune system because we are injecting a foreign entity into our body, into the patient. And in our clinical trial, we found no effect. As Alex highlighted, we found no effect of the phage on the gut microbiome. In fact, we observed only antibiotics effect on the gut microbiome because they on prolonged antibiotics. Severely ill patients. We have very small sample size though, so this is still judgment in progress.
So what does the TGA think of all of this?
Well, phage was treated as an investigational drug, but there are discussions now that the definition of phage is changed within the biological framework at TGA. It's now defined as medicine. So the regulation of phage is very similar to gene therapy. And it's more complicated than, you know, what I can explain in the podcast. Just to briefly say that we need to have a continued conversation with TGA as more scientific data comes to light. And with that, redefine how we can use phage in the clinical space. We did publish an article in Phage Directory, and this outlined the regulatory landscape of phage therapy in Australia.
Okay,
and because
cool.
we're the first one to do it in human, I think we have a lot more to contribute. And we just came back from Phage Futures Europe in Belgium. So this meeting, we had EMA, the European Medical Agency, present as well as a panel discussion. And I think FDA, EMA and TGA, they are all progressing nicely towards having a consensus or informed agreement on how the regulatory bodies can manage phage therapy. And of course, it rests on clinicians like John Iredale and scientists like us to educate the regulatory bodies on the pros and cons of phage therapy.
It's fairly urgent, isn't it, with the problem with multi-resistance going on around the world?
Yeah, if you read through the literature, hardly any pharmaceutical companies are investing money into antibiotic development.
We are also making an effort, working all together to establish a first phage biobank here in Australia, so we can isolate and generate our own phages and also getting phages from overseas to have them ready. We have patients to screen the patient isolates against phage library and find suitable phage candidates and then combine them.
It's a small community, and what I'm finding is that the phage community is very collaborative. You know, we help each other out. So it is actually quite easy to form a consortium, especially amongst the scientists. It's a multidisciplinary team. So we have the clinician in combination with, you know, bioinformaticians, scientists like me, phage biologists like Alex. And it's a very powerful combination that we can address every aspect of phage therapy. There's one more statement about clinicians.
Sure.
One of the comments from Phage Futures is that the clinical community is divided on how phage should progress. Some people really strongly believe it, and this is the case in Belgium. They have a consortium, they have a national system, they have a monograph about phage therapy, and they've been running this for over a year. They have specific surgeons that spearhead phage therapy in specific diseases, whereas in some countries, you know, even in our own backyard, we have clinicians that doesn't believe in phage therapy. Scientists like us and clinicians that actually advocate phage therapy still have a long way to go to present evidence to the scientific community and also to the medical community that this is effective and is safe and is tolerated by patients.
Thank you so much.
No problem, Alex. It's fascinating stuff. Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.